The first hall built was naturally what we call Founders Hall, and I have distributed a picture of it. Here is another one which has the name of the names of the incorporators under it, but what you don't see in these pictures is the absence of other buildings. That's what would make the difference. Founders Hall was intended to house everything. Faculty, students, laboratories, classrooms, dining room. It was, after all, a pretty small institution. And a one-building outfit was not unusual in those days. The next hall built was what's now the library, built in 1864, and finally in 1877, Barclay Hall. They both have been somewhat increased or improved in appearance. Barclay Hall had the great advantage of having a bad fire in its tower, and it doesn't end in the atrocious way towards the top that Taylor Hall does, for instance. They're both built by the same architect, I'm sorry to say. you can see the Bryn Mawr founded about 1885. Founders Hall, built in 1877 by two Quaker colleges, would be likely to employ the same architect. I don't want to say anything against him, except that he has some very admirable descendants, but anyhow, I'll say that for whatever his abilities are like. an accurate account of non-academic side of the college ought to give you some information about the increase of endowment. There have been important gifts. Jacob Jones left his whole estate here, and then in more recent times, Worcester Brown, who died in 1916, left $1.5 million, and William Phillips left $2 million. Morris Leeds left, I think, $1 million and a fraction. So that these generous benefactions to the college have helped it financially, though not enough to prevent the need of present income, present enlargement. I mentioned the gardener, incidentally, this English landscape gardener. He was the man that introduced cricket. Cricket was not played in the Murray, generally. And William Carville is his name, ran the greenhouse, planted the trees, and introduced cricket. And it remained, this college remained the most characteristic cricket-playing college in Murray. Now what about the curriculum and faculty? In the original plan it says that there should be a liberal education in ancient and modern literature and the mathematical and natural sciences under the care of competent instructors of our own society, capital S, that is, of course, so as not to endanger the religious principles or alienate the students from their early attachments. Being born friends, brought up as friends, they didn't want them estranged. But it did add a course of instruction as extensive as given in any literary institution in this country, and that means any college. There were, of course, men's colleges, quite a few of them by this time. Hereford is not, I've often been to academic occasions when the colleges are arranged in the order of age. And the delegates, when Professor Hare goes to represent Harvard at the inauguration of a new president, Oshkosh or somewhere, he'll find himself in the line of representatives dated about 1833. And there'll be a lot later than that, as well as some earlier. University, I was once in the procession where the University of Cairo, founded in about 900, was pretty well at the top of the line. And then came Harvard and Yale, Princeton, and a little further down, Haverford, they were represented. Another motive for building the college was, that I might have mentioned earlier, but I can mention right here. It said it didn't want the students estranged from their Quaker tradition. As long as there was no Quaker college, ambitious young men wanting a college education had to go elsewhere. And these early letters mention the fact that at that moment, six young friends were going to a Roman Catholic college in Maryland. Well, that's the kind of thing they wanted to avoid. And that was among their intentions. I think I mentioned last time the difficulty of finding teachers at the beginning, because very few Quakers had gone to college, and there was no Quaker college to train them. I suspect that one of the purposes in founding both Haverford and Bryn Mawr was to train Quaker teachers, and also the other colleges, perhaps even more. The other colleges were founded, the Quaker colleges for that matter. But they did find one or two that were Harvard graduates and were graduates elsewhere, and so they started their faculty, consisting of three teachers and originally 20 students. Beside the teachers, there was a superintendent and matron. Their objects, their duties, I think you would recognize. Here was a large farm to manage and buildings to manage. Here were a group of 20 boys that need some mothering, almost entirely away from their homes, not allowed to go home in vacations. Well, there were no vacations, or at least not allowed to go home. So they were here for a long time, subject to a chance of illness, and it was a large family over which the superintendent and matron presided. Those of you who know Hillis Hall next door here may have noticed pictures of the two Hillises, Samuel Hillis and his wife, who were the first superintendent and matron. And incidentally, you'll find all over the college the pictures of persons that I will mention and those I won't mention as well, noteworthy members of the administration. But I mention here this non-academic couple who presided at the beginning of the college. I put on the board a list of names. I don't know it's important to have them all, but I've indicated the president. That title didn't begin until 63, and you see that Samuel Gummery was the first president, and then you see that how they follow. Most of the names are familiar to you, three of them at least, because of their contribution to Quaker history. William Comfort, who wrote on Penn and Rillett and others, who was president in this period. Rufus Jones, not president, but for 41 years professor in the college and teacher of required course, so that for nearly half a century, every student in college had had a course from Rufus Jones. He also was a frequent speaker in fifth day meeting, first day meeting, and in one way or other, he influenced a great many of the Haverford alumni. Certain amount of dynasty here, which I put down. This family, you see, beginning in 33, and the last member to retire, Richard Gummery, went to Harvard in 1918. These, and Samuel Gummery, the president. Francis Gummery, professor of English, was, I guess, the most famous, generally famous professor in the faculty in that early period. He was a wonderful teacher, lived on the campus and taught English. He was an expert in ballads and in Shakespeare, and was a most contagious teacher in a field which played a good deal of influence. Thomas Chase and Pliny Chase were brothers, worked together here. They were the main faculty for that period. Those of you that have read the life of Rufus Jones know that they played a great deal of influence in his life. He graduated in 85, and you see they were still teaching in his time. If I had been complete, I should have put down another Comfort, shouldn't I? The son of President Comfort, who is now teaching Latin here. But this indicates a little bit of the dynastic tendency, though not as great as often occurs in colleges. On the whole, I'm more, yes, question?
I don't notice the name of Cadbury on there. Does this go back in any dynastic order at all, sir?
Well, I'm the only member of the family that's taught here, except my cousin, William Meade. But I haven't come down in modern times so much. And the relationship wasn't quite as close as father and son in some of these cases. Francis Gomery was the father of Richard Gomery, and Samuel Gomery was the father of Francis Gomery, and John Gomery, I guess, was the uncle of Samuel Gomery. The Gomerys came from Wilmington, from Burlington, a very cultivated Quaker family up there. The changes in the college are exactly what you would expect if you know American education over this period. Beginning as a boarding school and a disciplinary, limited, simple institution, church-related, as we say, with a great deal of emphasis on not only on discipline but on religion, and the two unhappily mixed together as though they were part of the same context. Blossoming out from that to what we know today, or even most of what we know today, was quite a change. Isaac Sharpless deserves some of the credit for that. He was the man that had to see the college through in his transition from a boarding school to a liberal arts college, and particularly not only in the academic side. He, by the way, had, I think, no college degree himself, but also in the point of view of control, freedom of student action, and so on. These are the growing pains of the shift in pattern in an institution. And the modern student in any college hardly realizes how curtailed he was in the earlier days. I say, never going home for vacation or never going off the campus without permission. Every moment of his day more or less regulated. Study hall, study together in one room under professorial supervision, very strict rules of every kind. However, they were not as rebellious as they would have been if they'd lived today. But it was a problem. I think it must have been in 1915 about that I was on the faculty committee to revise the catalog. You know, it's published every year. I discovered by looking up that the description of the college, and particularly its discipline, had not been revised since 1876, for some 40 years. the description of the college, still published in 1915, is very different from the fact. It had been liberalized in fact, but it hadn't been liberalized in description. It was an interesting revelation to me at that time of how the changes had taken place and were belatedly, only belatedly recorded. Of course, as I've suggested, the Quaker limitation was given up, not only in the student body, but also in the faculty, and even in the managers. This list that I spoke of last time says of Hereford, 12% students, Quakers, 20% of the faculty, Quakers, and 80% of the managers, Quakers. These changes are made pretty imperceptibly. They have to change the charter, of course, to permit 4 members of the Board of Managers to be non-Friends. That was done, I think, in 1930, fairly recently.